Maybe we can get through a day not talking about guns in America, but this is not that day. And we'll take a historical perspective, looking at guns, gun rights, and gun sales from the business end. Not the business end of the gun, but truly the business of making and selling guns. Pamela Haag focuses on the Winchester Company in her book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela Haag is a historian and a cultural commentator with a broad range of interests. One of her earlier books is about love in the post-Romantic age. Pamela also writes plenty of shorter works for publication in the likes of the Chronicle of Higher Education, the Huffington Post, and NPR. Pamela Haag, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
So, boy, if you're into cultural commentary, is there a bigger issue than guns in America?
Unfortunately, it's almost inevitably timely when you publish on this topic. So, this is recurring, and I don't think that there are many issues that are as polarizing as guns. Perhaps abortion, but I would say guns and abortion are probably the two most polarizing issues today.
You do a good job of picking things apart in here, though, and looking at the mystique of America and the relationship with guns and looking at what the sources of those are and whether they bear up under scrutiny. And you said you wanted to focus on the missing element of the gun culture. What is that?
Well, the missing element is in some ways the biggest element, which is that guns were a business. Guns were not all about our political life or the Second Amendment. They were always part of our economic life and our commercial life because they were being produced to be sold. And the gun industry very much acted like other industries. It had the same aspirations as other industries. It had the same business practices at the same points in history. So to me, it was important to infuse into the gun discussion the secret history of the gun, in which the gun is more like an unexceptional commodity, you know, and not an extraordinary object protected under the Second Amendment. And this is the part that I think has really been all but forgotten today.
You really light a fire right there in the introduction. It raises the question, does America's unique view of guns walk hand in hand with America's view of business?
To some extent, because unlike other contexts and other cultures, one of the things that really helped to build the American gun industry in crucial years in the 1800s was that we had an extraordinarily unregulated laissez-faire moment when businesses were left very much to conduct their business without regulation. So, for example, Winchester, Remington, and Colt were selling profligately abroad, doing a lot of international business, really a global commerce in guns in the mid-1800s, but they were under no political scrutiny whatsoever for that. So they were selling this product that was inflecting global politics, maybe in the direction to which the U.S. government would have been sympathetic and maybe not, but they were never subjected, you know, to any particular political intervention. Really, the first embargo powers were given to the president in 1898. So, yeah, I guess the two do go hand in hand. I mean, the legacy of the gun in America is also just a legacy of free enterprise and a system that treated guns as very similar to plows or hatpins or shoes. And in that sense, the gun really wasn't unique or exceptional as a commodity. It wasn't regulated in the ways that other countries did regulate firearms production.
How did you settle on on approaching this project through the lens of the Winchester Company?
Well, that's a really interesting story. I came to this project very roundaboutly. When I started, I'd never owned a gun. I hadn't even shot a gun. I had never been involved in gun control politics either. So one of the issues today is that people who write about guns typically love or hate guns, and the literature is very divided into those camps. But I actually came to this topic through a ghost story. When I was a graduate student in New Haven, a friend of mine introduced me to the legend of Sarah Winchester. So Sarah Winchester was the daughter-in-law of Oliver Winchester, who was the financier and the manufacturer of the Winchester repeater rifle. And the legend held that Sarah was a spiritualist, which was not uncommon in her day in the 1870s and 1860s, and that she had come to believe that all of these personal misfortunes in her life were because she was getting haunted by the spirits of people killed by Winchester rifles, the rifles that had made her a very wealthy woman. So I was just captivated by this figure of Sarah, and I started to research her and then set her aside because she was so elusive, ended up moving on to another project. Then Sandy Hook happened, the shooting in the elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut.
Which is about 40 miles from New Haven?
Yeah, very close. And I just saw my mind wandering back restlessly to Sarah. But this time I realized, you know, maybe I'm getting at the story from the wrong direction. I mean, she was a very mysterious figure, but so was Oliver. You know, I realized I know absolutely nothing about the gun industry, the history of the gun industry. You know, I've probably seen hundreds of Westerns. You know, I've read plenty of cowboy literature, but what do I know about the industry and the men who were making the guns that made the gun culture? So I went back to the archives, I rolled up my sleeves, and started inquiring into the history of the gun industry. Sarah is still in the book, but the records from the industry itself are quite fascinating.
Truly. And so Winchester gave you access to their archives, or are they in a different storage place now?
They're housed in Cody, Wyoming, at an amazing facility, the Center for the West. So they're deposited for researchers to use, as are the Colts records in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay, all kinds of great records here from Winchester, Colt, Remington. They're all mentioned in the book as we talk about Pamela Hague's The Gunning of America. We'll come back and talk more with Pamela and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is historian and cultural commentator Pamela Hague. She's written a book called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture, which she explored largely through the lens of the Winchester Repeating Arms Company, how America's position with guns got to be where it is today. A lot of history in here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 to share some stories or ask some questions. You can also go online and make emails. Make emails. That's a weird way to put it. Anyway, whatever verb you choose, you can send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Ultimately, Pamela, is this more of a marketing story than a story about the exercising of rights?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess I'd have to hedge my bets, and I would say that our gun culture today is about both, right? It's an overlay of this part that is truly exceptional, which is the Second Amendment. Other countries do not explicitly protect the right to bear arms. But it's that political and constitutional part overlaid with the story of commerce and the story of a gun industry that, just like every other gun industry, with each decade was producing in greater volume and needing to push beyond just the demand that already existed. You know, they were never going to do well or prosper just settling, you know, for the customers that were right at hand. You know, they were always looking for new markets. They were always looking for the most efficient way to sell guns. Really, the consumer, you know, the U.S. commercial market is not the market that really kept the gun industry alive in some of its most perilous years. So marketing is a part of this story. And it is a part that is almost entirely overlooked today. You know, I write in my book that we could be forgiven if we just thought that guns sprang fully formed from the head of the Second Amendment.
Right.
You know, they seem to never have any producer. They seem to never have any promoter. And I guess my argument is, yeah, of course the Second Amendment is important, but if the reader can take anything out of my book, I hope it's that guns were also a business. And there's nothing, you know, inherently nefarious about it. Businesses sell their product. They were very much in line with all of the business trends of of the day. And, you know, this is sort of the visible hand of business trying to sell a product. And they absolutely needed to do that.
Well, you know, and the effectiveness of any marketing effort is to take a want and turn it into a need.
Exactly. And that is very vividly revealed in the company archives around the turn of the century, you know, as we're moving into the 20th century. And if you think about it, this was a crucial moment for the gun and the gun industry. I mean, this is a moment when we're becoming this urban society. The frontier militarily is effectively closed. We're becoming more of a white-collar economy, a sedentary economy even. You know, there's fewer open spaces, which Theodore Roosevelt was endlessly mourning. So in the early 1900s, how is the gun industry going to survive, and what is it going to look like in this modern world? You know, technology goes obsolete all the time. I mean, maybe the guns that were involved in the conquest of the West would just fade. Maybe the gun would be less prominent. But that's not what happened. Winchester was very much in line with the move toward modern advertisement. All industries were doing this. And modern advertisement was very much about, you know, what amounted almost to a gospel, that it was the salesperson's job to create desire. You create demand. You know, you don't settle just for the customers that are walking through the door already knowing that they want a gun. So at that juncture, Winchester and the other gun companies really figured out how to deepen the mystique of their product, you know, to create new frontiers, so to speak, where people might want to be armed, and to create much deeper, intangible, emotional qualities around the gun. So I really think by the early 1900s, and in part because of the gun industry itself, we're really talking about a lot more than guns when we're talking about guns.
Pamela Hague's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Gunning of America. The claim that guns made the republic at the very beginning puts some historical test in here. How common were they at the dawn of the republic?
Yeah, well, that's another really good question. And colonial historians have struggled a great deal to figure that out because the records are spotty. They're not really good. But based on probate records and household inventories, most historians conclude that in the North was less heavily armed than the South, but in northern colonies, maybe 35% to perhaps half of households had some firearms. Now, these firearms were typically not in great shape. I mean, some of them had just been inherited through the generation. Some of them were in disrepair. Now, in the South, the gun ownership was higher. It could have been as high as two-thirds. But it's important to know that the records really aren't stellar on this point, and there's been a lot of controversy around how heavily armed the colonies were, but there was a big difference between the North and the South. And, you know, it's important to point out that for as much as the gun factors into our origin stories and the legends of our liberation and our freedom from Britain, they were also arming the slaveholding South. They were arming a slave economy in the South as well, which had nothing to do with liberty.
So let's talk about, and we have to point out, too, that this is pre-manufacturing. So in the colonial days and entering into the early days of the Republic, we're talking handmade guns here. The manufacturing, obviously, was what makes it important that we'll get to in just a few moments here. Congress, as you point out, established armories early on. And what was the purpose of those, Pamela?
Well, yes, producing guns by hand in this craft phase was incredibly difficult. The guns themselves were difficult to use and had the tendency to blow up in the shooter's face and a whole variety of other problems. And being a gunsmith was tough work, and it took a long time to produce one gun, and they were all unique. Now, this was a huge problem for the U.S. government, the fledgling government in 1798, because they wanted uniform guns where if something went wrong, you could swap out parts. But in 1798, there was no commercial incentive to put in this huge outlay of capital and time to try to think about how to manufacture guns in greater quantity, which we desperately needed, and to manufacture more uniform guns. So an intrepid Eli Whitney in 1798 decides he's going to take this project on, and he contracts with the U.S. government to make an astonishing number of 10,000 muskets, thinking he was going to use machines for the first time to make gun parts, interchangeable gun parts. Now, just to put that in perspective, there were 26 gunsmiths of the old craft style who took out contracts that same year, and they proposed altogether just to make 30,000. So Whitney's vision was really audacious, and it was kind of the crucible of the gun industry. And it was driven very much by public defense, by the need of the government to have arms. It wasn't driven by a commercial market. I mean, I think we tend to envision the gun customer today as Buffalo Bill or, you know, Charlton Heston. That individual consumer was not the consumer who got this business rolling. Without the support of the government, you know, basically doing venture capital, there just wouldn't have been an incentive to mass produce firearms. They were needed for the public defense. They were needed for war.
So if the government was what really made the early manufacturers, I guess, solvent, I mean, what was the view of just folks about individual ownership of guns in the early 1800s?
Well, I think for a lot of Americans, really in those first decades of the 1800s, the view was somewhat similar. I think for a lot of Americans, it was tied more to war. There was a view that these were weapons of war. And in the commentary around some of the first patented firearms, like Colts, they're described very much as weapons of combat. I think there was also a view of guns as tools and as things that were grouped with other useful objects, you know, of everyday life. I think that it's important to recognize that anecdotally, if you stop at any point in American history, you will be able to find someone who loved guns somewhere, and you will be able to find Americans who did not. You know, some Americans were quite disturbed by the weapons that Samuel Colt was devising and Oliver Winchester, and saw them as quite murderous and implements of slaughter. But you could also find Americans who really, for a variety of reasons, cherished the gun that they had. That's why I think that looking at the business records is a little more valid and quantitative.
We're talking to Pamela Haag about her book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. We have her for a few more minutes here on The Exchange. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You write that American gun culture was developed largely through patent litigation. How is that?
Well, think about how the view of guns changes when it moves from something produced for the government to something that is a competitive industry. One of the biggest changes is that once private capital is attracted to guns, and they're thinking, oh, maybe we can make some money off of this, maybe we can sell to the government, gun ideas became property. So these ideas, you know, were turned into property through the mechanism of the patent, and the patent rules were very generous at this time, and they were encouraged. They were designed to encourage innovation and to encourage commercial activity. There were over 500 patents taken out for breech loading firearms alone from 1800 to 1871. And necessarily, then the manufacturers and the capitalists who were supporting this gun industry, hoping to make some money off of it, found themselves engaged in a lot of patent battles. They either were lobbying. Samuel Colt would throw these lavish parties in Washington, D.C. at the Willard Hotel to lobby for patent extensions, which would give him an edge on the competition. Samuel Colt and Winchester also went to court endlessly to try to drive competitors out of the business by saying that they were infringing on their patents. Likewise, Daniel Smith and Horace Wesson, when Oliver Winchester first started manufacturing, said that he had violated their patent. So there are really about four or five key figures in the mid-1800s who battled with each other over the fiercely desired property of the idea of the gun as embodied in a patent. So that was a huge, it's like the forgotten frontier, you know, of the gun culture. It was really the courtroom.
It's interesting to think of the courtroom as the place where these battles got fought.
Yeah.
There's a side story about Samuel Colt we have to get in here. Before guns, what was he going around selling?
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating because the big gun titans, you know, who we still think of today, came into the business through such strange routes. Right before Samuel Colt opened his first factory in 1836, he was fresh off a tour under the fake title Dr. Colt, C C-O-U-L-T, demonstrating the amusing effects of nitrous oxide or laughing gas on volunteers that he would pluck out of his audience. And it's interesting because it gets at something that is really central to Sam McColl's character. He was an absolutely ruthless competitor in business, a very modern figure, but he was also a showman. He was a huckster. And Oliver Winchester had a lot of that too. And that need to create desire for the gun and promote it was very much part of the business. And Colt had that in spades. He just had that showman quality about him. One biographer thinks that he might have invented the phrase new and improved.
Really?
Yes.
But either way, we're talking about this massive marketing campaign. You know, no gentleman should be without this. And you know, people went and bought it.
Well, yes and no. I mean, initially, Samuel Colt, in typical style, you know, wildly overestimated any kind of civilian market. And again, at first, these gun kings, they really wanted to get military contracts because they were so efficient. I mean, that's where you were going to sell in bulk. You know, that's where you're really going to make money. But the Ordnance Department wasn't so impressed by these patented repeater firearms. They thought they were going to use too much ammunition. One of the Ordnance Department guys called them a great evil, and he thought they were just going to fade into oblivion, which, as we know, did not happen. The Winchester and Colt are really the modern firearms that shaped our civilian gun culture. But Colt really overestimated how many people were going to want this gun, and in fact went bankrupt in 1842, then reopened a factory in Hartford years later. Oliver Winchester, likewise, was tottering on bankruptcy for years and years in the mid-1800s.
So rough times for the major arms makers, and then the Civil War, I'm going to guess, turned everything around.
Yes, it somewhat turned things around. Samuel Colt did quite well. Oliver Winchester never actually got a major government contract, military contract during the war. His rival, Christopher Spencer, did get a major contract, maybe about 100,000 repeater rifles, simply because he had lobbying connections. He had amazing connections through the Navy. You know, otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten a contract either. But here's the thing. War is actually good fortune disguised as bad fortune disguised as good fortune, because they did great business during the war, but in Spencer's case, right after the war, he went bankrupt. There was a glut of rifles. He had overbuilt. You know, he couldn't possibly sell as many rifles in peacetime as he had during the war. Now, Winchester hadn't gotten a big government contract, but he had learned all these valuable lessons about the gun economy. In his letter book, he was writing in the 1860s about maybe it's a better strategy to scatter the guns, in his words, to individuals. You know, maybe I actually don't want to be lashed this kind of boom and bust cycle of war, of having the gun mostly be a weapon of war, because you'll do great business and then you're going to collapse right afterwards. So it's all very deceptive, but Winchester, I think, began really turning his attention more to a commercial market during the Civil War.
So after the Civil War, as you point out, it wasn't like people were snapping up Winchester repeaters. So what were the major sales to for Winchester in particular?
Yeah, to me, this is one of the most fascinating findings from the archives, and it's true of all four of the big gun makers. After the Civil War, demand was just abysmal, and the U.S. gun industry very easily could have failed. It was in a great struggle to survive at the time. So what did they do? They had invested all this capital in the machines to make guns, and they sought out an incredibly lucrative market, which was international. You know, really, the gun business was staying alive in these years after the Civil War through making these incredible sales, really, to almost every corner of the world. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a place that didn't have familiarity with some kind of American firearm by the 1880s. So Oliver Winchester survived, for example, by selling to the Ottoman Empire. He sold 20,000 rifles in 1870 to the Sultan. He survived selling in 1866 to the Juarez Revolutionary Forces in Mexico. Remington did a huge business almost everywhere, huge order to France, Egypt, Cuba, Spain, Argentina. And Colt did likewise, particularly selling to the Russian Tsar. That was an important part of Smith & Wesson's business as well. And I think that's important because we tend to think of America as having this unique gun pathology, or it's all about us, it's all about our relationship to guns. But when you look at this from a business, this was an international phenomenon. This was really kind of the first wave of globalization, and guns were right at the vanguard of that. So really, in a business sense, our gun culture was first built almost everywhere but America. You know, it was built in all these other places.
Interesting. And they turned around and made a market here. And as you point out, turned an unexceptional commodity into an exceptional commodity, which is obviously a lightning rod to this day. The book is called The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela Haig wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Pamela, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
It's good to have you.